You're listening to Reflections, the wisdom of Edgar Cayce. I'm Art Ray. Today's guest is Adrian Gilbert. Adrian Gilbert was born near London, where he attended St. Edmund's College, as well as the University of Kent at Canterbury, reading for an honors degree in chemistry. His first book, The Cosmic Wisdom Beyond Astrology, was written with the intent of bringing together scientific reasoning and mystical insight. As things have turned out, this has continued to be the hallmark of Adrian's writing and explains why his books have achieved worldwide recognition. In 1992, he met Robert Bovell, and together they wrote what was to become an international bestseller, The Orion Mystery. This was followed by a string of other best-selling books. Adrian Gilbert's ARE Press books include Signs in the Sky, 2012, Mayan Year of Destiny, available in print and audio formats, and the recently released Secrets of the Stone of Destiny, Legend, History, and Prophecy, all available at arecatalog.com. Thank you for coming on the show today.
Oh, it's great to come on. I'm really looking forward to it.
Could you tell us just what is the Stone of Destiny?
Right. Now, for those who are not familiar, the Stone of Destiny is a piece of sandstone, roughly 26 inches long by 16 inches wide by about 10.5 inches deep. And it's a coronation stone which slots in underneath the coronation seat of Edward I, which was made in about 1296. And all our kings and queens are crowned on it. They have to be sitting on this stone, which kind of bears witness that they are, in the eyes of God, being made king or queen.
Hmm. So then the throne itself was made in the 13th century.
That's right, yes, the end of the 13th century. Basically, this stone, before that, it was in Scotland, in a place called Scone, which is just a few miles outside Perth. And all the Scottish kings used to be crowned on it. And Edward I invaded Scotland. He was asked by the Scots to sort out their own problems about different candidates for kings. And he ended up taking the stone back to England. He was actually part Scottish himself, so he was, wasn't totally entitled to do that. But anyway, since then, for about 700 years, it resided in Westminster Abbey, and he had this special chair made, as the coronation seat. And it was there for about 700 years.
That's interesting that, they would take a stone from Scotland and revere it so much that the king would make a special chair to hold it. What was his motivation in doing that?
Right. Well, this is not just any old stone. It's got several different names. Stone of Destiny is one name, and the Stone of Scone is another. But it's also supposed to be Jacob's pillow stone. The prophet Jacob from the Old Testament. He has a dream where he sees angels going up and down a ladder, and he makes an agreement with God. God promises him good fortune as long as he does certain things. And he picks up, when he wakes up in the morning, he picks up the stone that he laid his head on and he pours oil over it and consecrates it. And that's known as Jacob's pillow stone. And this is allegedly the same stone. And I've been investigating the possibilities as to whether any of this could be true.
I guess you have to see the different viewpoints. First of all, where do the English, the people, well, I guess the Scots actually have it now since 1996. Where do the Scots say it came from?
Right. Well, the legend goes that it was it was originally in Ireland. And before that, it was brought to Ireland by people called the Tuatha De Danann, which some people translate as meaning tribe of Dan. You probably know that the tribe of Dan was one of the 12 tribes of Israel. And at the time of the breaking up of Israel in the 7th century BC, this stone was transferred, they say, to Tara in Ireland. And that's very interesting because Edgar Cayce himself actually has something to say about all this.
What did he say?
Right. Well, Edgar Cayce, I found four readings of his which mention the coming of princesses from the house of Judah, the daughters of King Hezekiah of Judah, coming to Britain and going to Stonehenge, or some stones near Salisbury, which must be Stonehenge, and doing certain rituals there and bringing knowledge with them. So this kind of ties in with this whole idea. We have other legends in Britain about princesses coming who are connected somehow with Egypt and with Israel, and one of these princesses marrying the King of Ireland and settling at Tara. So this is actually, you know, it's interesting that he's talking about the same thing.
What is the time frame for the, I guess, the transition from Israel, or did it go from Israel to Ireland, the stone?
Well, that's one of the possibilities. I've been exploring different possibilities. There's one that it went directly from Israel to Ireland with the people of this tribe of Dan. See, the tribe of Dan had land holdings in Israel. Each of the tribes had their own part of Israel that they lived in. The tribe of Dan had a part which was on the coast, around where Tel Aviv and Jaffa now are. And they were seafaring people. So when the Assyrians invaded, and then later on the Babylonians, it would be, you know, obvious that these people would jump into their boats and get out rather than become enslaved. So that's one possibility. Another possibility is that it was at the fall of Jerusalem in 586 BC that some of the Jews from Jerusalem fled to Egypt along with Jeremiah the prophet. And in the Bible it talks about Jeremiah bringing the princesses to Egypt. So there are other people there in Egypt who are also tied in with this legend. Particularly, there were some mercenaries who worked for the Egyptians. There were Greeks who came from a city called Miletus, who are known as the Milesians. And there were also Scythians who had come to Egypt, also working for the Pharaoh. And we know from historical records that these mercenaries were pushed out when there was a change of pharaoh. A different pharaoh came on the throne and he pushed the mercenaries out. And they wandered through northern Africa and Spain and ended up in Ireland. So this is the legends that are connected with the Scottish migration, because the Scots, the name Scots or Scut, comes from Scythe, which is Greek for Scythian. So, and the Scots claim to be Scythians. So this makes sense. It all begins to tie together.
After doing all the research on the origin stories, where do you personally think it comes from?
Well, this is very, very interesting, because I've done other research on the stone itself and on the shape of it, the dimensions of it. And I found that the stone is measured in what are called half cubits. A cubit is a measure from Egypt of, which is 21 inches long, a royal cubit. So half a cubit is 10 and a half inches. And this stone is measured so that it has dimensions of 2.5 by 1.5 by 1 of half cubits, which is interesting because the Ark of the Covenant had the seat area on the top of the Ark of the Covenant was 2.5 by 1.5 whole cubits. So the plan of the stone, if you like, is the same as the Ark of the Covenant, except that it's reduced, you know, using half cubits instead of whole cubits. Otherwise, it would be too heavy to carry.
Now then, I was wondering, you're speaking about cubits. People think that perhaps the stone originated in Ireland. Did the Irish use cubits, or is there any way to tell what their standard unit of measurement was, or did they have one back then?
Yeah, I haven't examined the Irish units of measure, but certainly we had them in Britain. We had a whole load of different measures which are tied in with the ancient Egyptian measures. So it's quite possible, yes.
Then the connection to the Egyptians is derived from the cubits?
Well, that's part of it, but the other thing I've discovered as well is that you can use this stone, you can tie strings around it, and there's three ways that you can tie the strings around a solid object like this, and it gives you three different lengths. If you imagine these strings tied together at the corners, it gives you a triangle. Yeah? And using that triangle, you can actually do a very simple geometry, and you can produce the method of squaring the circle, from which you can derive the shape of a pyramid. Now, that might sound a bit obscure and a bit offbeat, but actually we have an Egyptian papyrus, which is now in Berlin, which tells us how the king who built the Great Pyramid, Khufu, asked a magician called Djedi how he could find out the dimensions or the proportions, the numbers, that he needed to use to make his pyramid. And Djedi said that there's actually there's a flint block or flint stone in a room in Heliopolis, and that the dimensions could be derived from that.
We'll be right back with more with Adrian Gilbert on Reflections. You're listening to Reflections, the wisdom of Edgar Cayce. We're back with Adrian Gilbert.
Djedi said that there's actually there's a flint block or flint stone in a room in Heliopolis, and that the dimensions could be derived from that. So there must have been a stone that was similar, if not the same one, that was at that time. We're talking about the time before the pyramids were built. So this must be around 2700 BC or something, that was actually in Heliopolis in Egypt. So I see this stone as possibly coming from Egypt.
If it were to come from Egypt, what was the original purpose of creating the stone?
Yeah. Well, it could be two purposes. One is that it's sort of preserving secret knowledge, that, you know, only the priesthood who are initiated would know how you can use this stone to derive the dimensions, the right proportions for the pyramid. So you've got the knowledge there preserved. And we do know from Egyptian texts that their god, or if he was a god, Thoth, was supposed to have recorded information on stones in Egypt. So it could be that this is one of the items that he actually had made, you know, in legendary times, who knows when. The other reason could be this whole idea about a stone being used to make a covenant with God, that you take an oath in the presence of a stone, a particular stone, significant stone, because a stone will last forever, theoretically. It'll last a very, very long time. And it bears witness to what you've done, what you've said. And every time you see it, and every time anybody else sees it, they're reminded of that covenant that you've made. It's rather like when Moses comes down from Mount Sinai, and he's carrying the two stones on which are written the Ten Commandments. And he drops them when he sees what's going on below, you know, people passing and dancing around a bull or something. But then they pick up those pieces and they put them into the Ark of the Covenant. The Ark of the Covenant is a box, and it's a box in which you keep the documents of your covenant, which in that case was the Ten Commandments. Well, this could be a similar covenant, perhaps connected with the covenant of Noah.
Does it matter what happens to it?
Well, I think it does. I mean, we've been looking after these things in Great Britain for a very long time. First of all, in Scotland, and then in England, and now they're back in Scotland. But this is supposed to be the covenant documents, if you like, for our royalty. And the Queen actually, when the Queen is crowned, it's not just quite as simple as clonking a crown on her head. First of all, she comes into the church. She's done in church. She's done in Westminster Abbey. And the assembled nobility, all dressed up in their finest, the earls and the dukes and the viscounts and all the rest, all dressed up in ermine, they have to acclaim her as being the next monarch, which they always do, of course. And then she has to take a coronation oath. She has to swear that she's going to serve her people and that she's going to preserve the Christian religion of the Protestant Church in England. She has to swear that on the Bible. And then the chair, the famous chair of Edward the First, is placed in front of the tomb of Edward the Confessor, who's a saint in the eyes of Christians or the church. And she then is crowned in front of the tomb of Edward the Confessor. So this is all very religious and very much, it's a bit like a marriage vow, actually. You know, when you get married in church, you do it in front of the altar. And so it's very much like you're taking a vow, you're taking an oath that you're going to do what you say you're going to do, and God's going to witness it. And the stone is there sort of as God's witness.
That's interesting, because, I don't know, as I'm an attorney, and the Bible is revered as what you put your hand on, and that's, for most people, that's how you take the oath. So that shows the place, I guess, in their esteem of where this stone is, that they would use it to be a witness to their oath.
Absolutely. And I mean, in Britain, and I don't know if the same thing's ever happened here, perhaps it has, but there have also, in the past, there's been times when people would swear an oath on their father's tomb, or their grandfathers, or the ancestors. They would go to a particular monument, and this is actually probably what was going on in Scotland at Scone Palace, where there is actually a mound, a tumulus. And I'm pretty sure that they use that tumulus. That's where they used to put the stone, and they'd take the oath. That tumulus was probably the tumulus of some great ancestor, some ancestral king. So you're actually taking your oath in the eyes of your ancestors, as well as in front of the stone. It's the same in the coronation in front of Edward the Confessor's tomb. And actually these days, of course, so many of our kings and queens are buried in Westminster Abbey. It's not just him. It's the whole dynasty is looking on, as it were, perhaps as ghosts, spirits in the spirit world, watching what's being done and saying, yes, okay, you've taken your oath. We've witnessed it, so you better live up to it. It's like that, really.
Where do you think the stone might go next?
Well, this is a very good question. Currently, I think it's in the wrong place at the moment. If it's going to be in Scotland, then I think the chair ought to be taken up there as well. And it should be put in St. Giles Cathedral, which is the Cathedral of Edinburgh, and the stone put back inside it, and it should be kept there, because this is really a holy relic. It's not something that we should be treating with derision. But at the moment, it's in a glass cabinet in Edinburgh Castle, and it's sort of like it's a museum piece. And I think that's the wrong attitude, because that sort of makes the attitude that this all belongs in the past. It's not something that's relevant in the present. It's something that you can just look at and say, oh, yes, that's how they used to do things. Well, you know, if our monarchy means anything to us, and I can understand that people in America perhaps don't have the same emotion towards the monarchy that we do in Britain, but if the monarchy is meant to mean anything, then the Queen's legitimacy, if it's not going to come from democracy, which you would have if you had a president, obviously, a president elects it, it's the people that choose. But if you're going to have a monarchy, then the only justification for it is that it's got some kind of religious connection. It's God has decided it by giving this person birth into that particular family or whatever, you know, that you're looking at it that way. And if you remove that, and if you say, well, she's just queen because she just happens to be queen, it kind of delegitimizes, at least to some extent, the whole thing and makes it a bit shaky. So I think we should be treating her with more respect. And if we're going to leave the stone where it is now, well, then we ought to make a copy of it and put that back in the throne, because it's an important symbol, and symbols do have importance in the world. You can't just ignore them and neglect them. It causes damage.
Do you think there's anything supernaturally significant about the stone?
Well, I do, actually. But this is a thing, you know, perhaps some people might think I'm a bit strange thinking this, but there is a kind of aura connected with certain objects. I mean, we're all familiar with saints' relics, aren't we?
Mm-hmm.
We recently had a tour of St. Teresa of Lisieux. They were bringing her relics around, and there were queues going round the cathedral in London when the relics were brought there, and I'm sure it was the same in the rest of the world. I think they've been all over the place. And it's because people feel that these relics have imbued in them a certain kind of presence or energy or connection with that saint. And certain objects have this about them. There's another one, the German equivalent to the Stone of Destiny is the Spear of Destiny, which is allegedly the spear that was used to pierce the side of Jesus Christ when he was on the cross. Now, whether it was or not doesn't really matter. It's the fact that this spear has got that association with it, and it gives it a kind of aura or presence that kind of can be used for good or ill. And, you know, one of the first things Adolf Hitler did was to steal that spear from the museum in Vienna where it had been kept. And he took it, and he somehow managed to wield its power. And that was one of the sources of his extraordinary career. As long as it lasted anyway, it was extraordinary. But the stone has this same kind of presence to it, that somehow if the stone is there and it's being looked after and it's in the right place and the right person on the throne, it becomes a kind of totem of protection, that you're sort of under the protection of God's wing. And throughout the Second World War, that stone was in Westminster Abbey, and the King and Queen were in their palace. And I think it's very significant that there was this kind of clash between the Nazi regime wielding the Spear of Destiny and the island of Britain, which in 1940, in the summer of 1940, was the only opposition to this Nazi domination of Europe. At that time, Russia and America weren't involved, and everyone else in Europe was either crushed or they were neutral, or they were allies of the Nazi regime. So somehow Britain managed to sort of hold at bay this presence, and I'm sure the stone had something to do with that. And after that, you know, it sort of broke the spearhead, as it were, and you know, we were able to come through it. It, you know, cost everyone a great deal in suffering and time and money and everything, but we came through that ordeal. So I sort of feel it's important that we should be looking after this totem of this significant relationship, if you like, with God.
That was, I guess it was kind of alarming. I read about how in 1950, some people had the idea of bringing it back to Scotland, and yeah, it broke. Wouldn't it have been better just to have been taken care of in England for a bit longer? But I don't know. It's for something that significant, that's just so sad for that to happen.
Yeah. But you see, sometimes things that happen seemingly by chance can be symbolic of something else.
We'll be right back with more with Adrian Gilbert. You're listening to Reflections, the Wisdom of Edgar Cayce. Let's continue our conversation with Adrian Gilbert.
Sometimes things that happen seemingly by chance can be symbolic of something else. They took that stone in 1950, and I think they were very shocked when they broke it. I mean, so it was probably already cracked, but nobody knew because it was stuck in the throne there. And as far as we could tell, it, you know, it looked perfectly all right. It probably already was cracked. That's one reason why they returned it, is they realized that they couldn't look after it properly. But it is significant that it's cracked, and now Scotland wants to become independent, or a lot of people there do. So maybe that's kind of symbolic, you know, the breaking up of Britain. I don't know.
When England took the stone originally in 1296, was that an effort to bring unity with Scotland?
That was certainly a major part of it. The king who did this, King Edward I, was known as the Hammer of the Scots, and he's also known as Longshanks, because he's very tall. He modeled his career on King Arthur, and he believed that he was going to do what King Arthur did. And King Arthur unified, you know, Britain under one throne. So he didn't mind people having their own thrones, as long as his was the high throne and he was the high king. So he first of all conquered Wales, or what was already not conquered in Wales, in the north, and brought that within his own jurisdiction. And then he did the same with Scotland, or at least he attempted to. And So bringing the stone back and putting it under his throne was very significant in that respect. But as I say, he was part Scottish himself, so it wasn't totally a wrong thing to do.
When it comes to the scientific aspect and the chemical makeup of the stone, could the stone have been quarried in Egypt, or are there stones similar in Egypt, or are there stones similar in Ireland or Scotland? Can they tell the origin of it from the chemical makeup?
Well, if you read textbooks, they'll all say that this is a piece of sandstone typical of the region around Perth. But I've yet to see any actual report that says this. So you get one book that quotes another book, which quoted a previous book, and everybody quotes everybody else, but nobody actually carries out chemical tests and trials. But certainly, the sandstone in Egypt and the sandstone in Israel, and you could just as well say, well, this is typical of the sort of stone you find in Egypt. I've seen sandstone in Petra, in Jordan, red sandstone. So there's sandstone everywhere. I would love to see someone do an actual test to see exactly where this comes from, but maybe that's quite a difficult thing to do. I don't know. But even if it isn't, even if this is only a copy, the idea of this stone, quite clearly from its dimensions, comes, I think, from Egypt. And maybe it's quite possible that the stone was taken by Moses, maybe, to Israel at the time of the Exodus, and then was brought back to Egypt sometime later at the fall of Jerusalem, and then was taken from there to the British Isles. I think that's certainly a possibility. And I can even imagine a situation where the stone was inside the Ark of the Covenant at one time, because it would be the right size to fit in there. It would fit in quite happily alongside those other tablets of stone and Aaron's rod and whatever else they wanted to put in there. So there's all sorts of possibilities with this. But even if this stone, the actual stone itself is local to Scotland, I don't see that as meaning that it has no significance, because it's actually the shape and the meaning of the thing that matters, not the substance of it.
When were the handles put on the stone?
Well, there's another big question. This stone is obviously, it goes back to long before the Iron Age. We're talking about Bronze Age, possibly earlier, maybe even Stone Age, when it was first manufactured. So we've got to wonder, when were these iron handles put in? I think it's quite likely that they were put in at the time of Edward I. But I would love to see someone do some testing on that. Somebody knows a bit about metallurgy and what people were doing at different times using iron. There's a kind of chains on it, and these circular, not hooks, but rings that you can thread a pole through. So you can imagine someone putting the pole through the rings on either end, and then maybe two men in front and two at the back carrying the thing, because it weighs about 300 weight, which is 336 pounds. So it's quite a weight. But you can imagine people carrying this thing through using these rings with the put on the ends there. Otherwise, it would be quite difficult to move around, wouldn't it? A big lump of stone like that.
Oh, yes. You mentioned the possibility of a copy. What do you think of the conspiracy theories, maybe I shouldn't call them conspiracy theories, the theories that the original stone is hidden somewhere?
Yeah, you see, whenever you have something like this, you're always going to have conspiracy theories. There's always going to see the when it was in England, it used to please a lot of Scots. Say, well, of course, they never got the real one. The abbot, Scone Abbey, when he heard that Edward's men were coming, he hid the real one. And what he gave them was just a drain cover. So then they can have a good laugh and say, well, the kings of England have been crowned on a drain cover. But did they have drains in those days? I mean, we're talking about 1296 here, and it didn't have flushing toilets. You wouldn't really have drains. The only thing that you would have might be a cover for a well, but if it was wells are normally round in shape, and it would be a bit small to be used as a cover for a well. So that doesn't really stack up in my view, especially because the dimensions are so significant and they tie in with the shape of the pyramid and so forth. So then you have to ask yourself, well, okay, but maybe when it was stolen in 1950, maybe they made a copy then and swapped it. But the ringleader of that group, who's now a QC, himself says no, that this, we returned the same one that we took. He doesn't, he swears that this is the same stone that was taken and hasn't been swapped. So I don't think these so-called conspiracy theories really hold water. I think we are looking at the genuine stone, and so we ought to be treated with more respect.
Well, now, we've been talking about all this from your book, Secrets of the Stone of Destiny, Legend, History, and Prophecy. Also in your book, you mention Stonehenge. Is there a connection between this stone, the Stone of Destiny, and Stonehenge?
Well, there might be, is all I can say about that. Stonehenge itself, if you sort of analyze the patterns of it, you discover that the kind of geometry that's being used is also connected with the pyramids. A guy called John Michel did a lot of work on this. I knew him. He passed away a few years ago. So there is that symbolic connection. But also in Yegor Casey readings, they do talk somehow about when these princesses came to Stonehenge, they set up some kind of chair. So it's possible that the stone was brought there for a short time anyway, on its way to Ireland. So I think, we shouldn't discount that. Stonehenge itself, of course, is much older than that. So Stonehenge itself goes back to around about 3000 BC, the first stage of it, and was built, I think, going up progressively for about 1,000 years. So the what we call Stonehenge today, with those circles of big sarsen stones with lintels on, they're probably about 1500 BC or something like that. So it's possible that there was already a ruined Stonehenge there when these princesses arrived, and that they and their people did some kind of spiritual work within the context of Stonehenge, maybe using this stone they brought with them. I guess we'll never know, but maybe some psychometric dowser or clairvoyant or someone like that might be able to do something on that and to have a look.
Oh, yes. That'd be fascinating. I just wonder, who exactly has the stone now? What's the name of the institution?
It's in Edinburgh Castle at the moment, so it would still be under the jurisdiction of the monarchy. Theoretically, it's the Queen who's sent it up there, but she's only done so because her government asked her to do that. I would like to see her reverse that decision and bring it back. But I think that could cause a lot of problems, perhaps, in Scotland. I don't know. But whatever we do, I think the stone and the throne ought to be put together. And we should either send up the throne as well and put that into St. Giles Cathedral and put the stone in there and keep it there, or we should bring the stone back to London and put it back in the throne. Because I think it's a bit like, you know how on the Manhattan Underground, the metro, that when they decided to clean all the graffiti off the trains, the crime figures for New York fell significantly.
We'll be right back with more with Adrian Gilbert on Reflections. You're listening to Reflections, the Wisdom of Edgar Casey. We're back with Adrian Gilbert.
When they decided to clean all the graffiti off the trains, the crime figures for New York fell significantly.
Mm-hmm.
And because it's sending out a certain message, it's saying, actually, we value these trains. We value this we value our city, and we don't want it messed up, thank you very much. And if you're going to mess it up, we're going to put you in jail. And sending out that message clearly. And it's a bit like that when you start pulling your throne apart and you pull the stone out after 700 years. You're saying, well, it's actually, this doesn't really matter to us very much. Do what you like. We don't care anymore. And when you do that to your country, when you do that to your throne, you're actually doing it to your country. And it's as though you took your Declaration of Independence and Bill of Rights, and you said, we're not going to keep these in the Smithsonian anymore. We're just going to stick them in wherever. We don't care anymore.
Or send them to Canada. I don't know.
We're going to send them to Canada, or we're going to auction them on eBay or something, And it would send the wrong signal about how the United States thinks about itself. And I think that we've done that in Britain by doing this. We're saying, well, actually, we don't care anymore. We don't care if Scotland goes off and does its own thing. We don't care if we stay United Kingdom or not. We don't really care about our monarchy anymore. Do what you like. We'll just be part of the EU. We'll just be, a statelet on the edge of Europe. And I think that's sending the wrong signal myself.
Now, we've been talking about the Stone of Destiny. You've also written the book. I mean, you've written many books, but you've also written 2012, Mayan Year of Destiny. I was wondering, have you heard about the recently discovered cave that has additional Bakhtuns, I guess, that go beyond 2012?
Yes, I have heard about that. I think anyone that's really made any study of the Mayan stuff knows this anyway, that the Mayans were not saying it's the end of the world in 2012. It's the end of a particular age. But they, even on the pyramid of inscriptions at Palenque, there are numbers which go way beyond that. They go, millions of years ahead. So, we're just going to move into a different age. But the big question is, what does that signify? And I think there is going to be a change in consciousness coming around shortly. That we're going to wake up from a dream, as it were. And then we're going to move into a different age, which is going to be perhaps a bit less materialistic than this one's been. At least that's what I hope. But certainly, no, I would not say this is going to be the end of the world. It's the end of their calendar. And it's like when any calendar ends, one calendar ends and you start another one, don't you?
Oh, yes.
It doesn't mean it's the end of everything. It's like the hands on the clock have gone to 12. And, the big hand and the little hand, both pointing at 12. But that doesn't mean the clock's going to stop at 12, and it just starts the next day, doesn't it? And I think that's what's going to happen, and we're going to find out that something else is going to begin.
Wow. Well, we're about out of time. Do you have a website where people can learn more?
Well, I used to. I've closed my website down because I wasn't really doing very much, but I have a Facebook page. So if people go on Facebook, and they go to facebook.com/ A.G. Gilbert 1. They'll find me there. And they'll be very well to come along. They can send me messages, and they can click the like box, and that means that they'll receive any postings that I make on that page.
Oh, yeah.
Probably the best way to keep in touch with me.
Okay. And for this book, again, the title of the book is Secrets of the Stone of Destiny, Legend, History, and Prophecy. And I want to thank you again for coming on the show.
Well, thank you. I've very, very much enjoyed it.
Well, it's time for the Thought for the Day. And today's Thought for the Day will be read by Kimberly Rose, who works with the ARE and wrote the book Wake Up Your Intuition, and also teaches the class based on that book. Hi.
Good morning. I love this reading. It's very simple, and it's very to the point. That's something that we could all bring into our lives as a really true vibration. It's 24-28-1. For this, the ideal, as it is set, should not be not as to what others should do to make the ideal situation for self, but as to how self may apply itself in its ideal to bring the ideal relationships with others.
Well, what does that mean to you?
Personal responsibility. And the example I would love to use is that we blame others. They're not doing this for us. And so my life isn't fulfilled. It's, you know, and so it's constant looking outside and not being in your spirit. Even down to, I hear, you know, well, you know, if the president or if this person would just do more, it has to start on an individual basis. And when it starts on an individual basis, then truth can be felt in a place that's collective by others.
Ah, yes, this speaks of the ideal, which is something I know Casey talks about, and I guess the importance of not approaching it so that you're creating this ideal situation for yourself, but you're addressing your relationships with others. So it's another reading that talks about reaching out to others as part of society.
Yes. Yes, and that's what Casey was all about, just giving and loving. And I remember hearing a story about, you know, he was told, you know, you've got to slow down. You're going to be sick. And he said, how can I do that when I can hear the cries from the letters that people are sending me? He could feel them. And he was about serving, but also knowing that in your life, eating healthy and honoring yourself and living a spiritual life, like exercising, so many things, and like incorporating those into your life, you have to have a balance.
Oh, yes. Wow. Well, thanks for doing the thought for the day today.
Thank you.
That's all the time we have for the show today. Thanks to Adrian Gilbert for talking to us. Make sure to look up his book, Secrets of the Stone of Destiny, Legend, History, and Prophecy, at arecatalog.com. Thanks also to Kimberly Rose for the thought for the day, and most of all to you, the listener. Thanks for listening to Reflections, the Wisdom of Edgar Casey.